Splashing seats is our go-to. That is what we do, is slash seats. So it wasn't a curiosity in Glasgow.
Yeah, well, it's better than slashing on seats. No, actually, is it? I'm not sure. But I know that you said that firmly with your tongue in your cheek, so we can go back to Glasgow. Breathe a sigh of relief, everybody.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 3 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. In his first speech to the Labour Party conference as Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer will warn of a shared struggle ahead to build a new Britain. But the Labour leader will also try to follow the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, in presenting a more positive vision for the future and light at the end of the tunnel. Our political correspondent Ian Watson is at the conference in Liverpool.
I think the worry that some delegates have, and certainly some of the trade unions, is just how long is that tunnel going to be before they reach the promised land. So I think what he's going to try and do is give a glimpse of where he wants to get to, a country with greater economic growth, greater investment. There'll be a smattering of specific policies, I think, around skills, for example. And he'll be saying more on welfare reform because he has to obviously identify savings in the budget in order to put investment elsewhere.
Health officials in Lebanon say nearly 500 people, including 35 children, have been killed by Israeli airstrikes in the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border in nearly 20 years. A spokesman for the Israeli military, Daniel Hagari, acknowledged the loss of life but said 1,300 Hezbollah targets had been hit.
Regarding the high number of casualties, everyone is a tragedy in Lebanon. Among those killed were a large number of Hezbollah terrorists who were next to the weapons that we targeted. Israel is facing threats on all fronts and continuing to act against them in defense for the people of Israel.
Official figures to be released this morning are expected to show a record low in planning approvals for new housing developments in England for the second quarter of 2024. It highlights the scale of the challenge facing the new government in meeting its ambitious targets for building new homes. Ben Chu reports.
The government has pledged to build 1.5 million new homes in England over this parliament, but residential planning permissions granted by local councils in England hit a record low in the first 3 months of the year, and figures for the next 3 months to June are predicted to show another record low. House builders say planning permissions are a leading indicator of future construction, and that their collapse this year shows just how difficult it will be for the government to hit its targets. Ministers have promised to reform the planning system, but experts warn that reform alone will not be sufficient because of a drop in planning applications.
The former BBC radio and television presenter Chris Searle, best known for his role in the consumer affairs show That's Life, has died aged 81. Dame Esther Ranson described her Bristol-born former co-star as funny, clever and charming. A new research has found that octopuses sometimes cooperate with fish when hunting for food, such as crabs. Scientists observe fish identifying prey and then the octopus using their 8 arms to reach inside rock crevices to capture it. They also found octopuses punching fish, apparently as a way to make them work harder. BBC News, it's now 3 minutes past 3.
On Radio 4, the more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as the coming storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Dotun Adebayo. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, for the World Football phone-in tonight, we've got the Scottish football writing legend, Hugh McDonald. So we've got the, well, our own legendino, Tim Vickery. He's in Rio, of course. And Hugh, where are you? Do you mind me asking?
Hey, I'm in Stirling at the moment.
Okay. Stirling job you're doing in Stirling. But I'm sure you've heard that before. Yeah, and by text.
If he had a pound for every time that someone mentioned Stirling,
he'd be broke. Only a pound. I grew up in Royal Tunbridge Wells, says our listener. I grew up in Royal Tunbridge Wells. And the reason why we're talking about this is we're trying to compile a map, a football map of Britain, where things happened. The towns and villages and areas which have left their legacy indelibly on football forever and ever and ever, actually. That's what we're trying to do tonight. It's not easy, but we need your help. So 08085909693. If you can contribute to a story about football in Britain and identify the town or the village or whatever it might be that has that legacy, then talk to me. We're just finding out about the reason why Aberdeen is significant. See, not people knew this. Not a lot of people knew this. Aberdeen is the town or city, it is indeed, isn't it? I should ask you that, Hugh. It is a city, isn't it?
Oh, it's a city. Very much a city, yeah. Yeah.
I'm just checking. but Aberdeen, is this city in this country that introduced the dugout to football? Who would have known? Hey, who would have known that? I didn't know that. And many of us didn't know that, but you never know when the kind of question will come up on a pub quiz. And there you will be getting all the free beers for life because you answered that correctly. And you don't thank me for that, but you thank Kathleen in Aberdeen who brought that to our attention after getting off the bus, seeing this tribute to the person who brought dugouts to Britain in Aberdeen. That's what we're looking for tonight. 08085909693. We're also looking for... Oh, I didn't finish reading out that text. No, I grew up in Royal Tunbridge Wells, and the reason why it's Tunbridge Wells is because that was the home of Sabutio, the it's not really a kid's game, isn't it? It's very much an adult game as well.
It's serious business.
It is, actually. And your parents, particularly your fathers, will give you an elbow and shove you off the dinner table so that they can play with your Sabutio. That was once upon a time. And Royal Tunbridge Wells is where the game was invented. And it's now a World Championship game that... the World Championships this year took place in Tunbridge Wells, in Kent. So, our listener says, I grew up in Royal Tunbridge Wells and remember growing up with Sabutio. Dad did some legal work for them and I remember Mum painting the figures like many did at home around the town. Ah, I am more interested in cricket than football. Tim, you know what's coming, don't you?
I do, yeah. They did have a Sabutio cricket as well, although it didn't work very well.
Yeah, do you know, I wonder why. I could have told them, it ain't going to work. It ain't going to work. Yeah, you know what's coming, but I don't, because they've taken it off my little computer here. Somebody's taken it off.
Has someone taken your toys away?
Yeah, they've taken my toys away. No, I'm going to cry. I've thrown my toys out of the bathwater. Yeah, oh, what a shame. Because I was supposed to do, I don't like cricket. Oh, no. Anyway, here we go. Dad did some legal work for the Sabutio people. And I remember Mum painted the figures like many did at home around the town, which suggests that it was, you know, they created a cottage industry there. Because I always wondered how they painted those figures. And so minutely, I am more interested in cricket than football. And RTW in Southborough also used to be important for cricket ball manufacturing back to the 1700s. Oh, Royal Tunbridge Wells, cricket ball manufacturing. First county match, Kent versus London in 1719. I'll tell you what, that will be at the top of our agenda where when we, here at the World Football Phone-In, do a cricket map of Britain, yeah? It's all in the, it's all on the tin. World Football Phone-In cricket map of Britain. It's a match made in heaven, surely. Oh, and Dave, my birthday twin, says Goodison Park, I believe, hosted the first game with shirt numbers 1 to 11 and also first floodlit game. This is a classic, isn't it? Because once upon a time, they didn't have shirt numbers and then they tested it out for the first time. What I remember about this, Tim, was everybody had the same number. It was like every single player had number 1 or something like that. Well, when they were first testing out shirt numbers, what, in the 20s or something like that?
Yeah, I think the natural thing would be to have a progression. If you have 11 players, you start at 1 and end at 11.
Of course.
If they all have the same number, that's going to be very confusing, I would imagine.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, that's, clever. You know, in hindsight, obviously. But at the time, you know, they thought it was cleverer to all have the same numbers. And it looked impressive. So we've got Goodison Park then for another reason going on to our football map of Britain. So let me introduce somebody else into the conversation tonight as well, because we've talked about Sabuto, one way of playing football, of course, and there are many ways of playing football and many aspects of playing football as well. We have got with us this morning David Duke, who is from Street Soccer Scotland, which is a charity which aims to create purpose, hope and relationships using football. David, welcome to the World Football Family.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thanks very much. Tell me about this 2024 Homeless World Cup, which kicked off over the weekend in Seoul, in South Korea.
Yeah, sure. It's good to see you. See if I'm all your face on the screen.
Great to see you.
I'm in Seoul.
Oh, you're in Seoul at the moment.
Hi, I'm as well. Nice to meet you.
What's it like out there at the moment? What's it like?
It's very warm. As you can probably see with my red face and my sweaty forehead.
Yeah, but your red face does match your fridge beside you.
I know.
Yeah, it does, actually.
It's Airbnb. what's it like? So the city's amazing in terms of, you know, it's so kind of different from anything, you know, you can experience, certainly in Europe. People are really friendly, but the tournament itself is just, it's always hard to describe in words. Words probably don't do it justice in terms of the atmosphere and the, you know, the kind of whole kind of carnival feel to it, because you've got, you know, 40 countries there from all over the world, from all the continents. And everyone's there just, you know, playing football, but creating new memories and meeting new people and, you know, getting to the World Cup is the, you know, is part of a journey that they've been through to actually get there, you know. And
World Cup. Why homeless World Cup? Is this a World Cup of rough sleepers?
Well, it's the homeless World Cup. So the players come from kind of homelessness and social isolation. So, you know, there will be players who are maybe currently sleeping rough or, you know, currently staying in hostels. There'll be players who are in, you know, temporary accommodation, you know, sofa surfing, players have coming through maybe medical backgrounds, mental health and so on. So there's a whole kind of mix of where the players come from. But you said why the Homeless World Cup. I think, you know, for 20 years now, the Homeless World Cup has shown that football can play a massive kind of part in people's lives, you know, the beautiful game, you know, bringing a bit of hope, a bit of purpose, you know, bringing a community around someone. Because, you know, if you look at homelessness as a, how does homelessness happen? It often comes from people not having a lack of support or support systems for when tough times come. You know, there's maybe been a crisis or there may have been a health issue. And when you don't have a support network, you know, then sometimes doing that alone can then lead to homelessness. So, you know, what the Homeless World Cup brings and organisations like Street Soccer Scotland and Street Soccer London brings is allows players to be part of something, you know, taking people out of isolation and putting a, you know, a community around them through football, and then allowing people to access the different levels of support they might need. Bear in mind, everyone's different and everyone needs different levels of support. It could be, you know, for housing, and it could be just even just having some purpose and having somewhere to be in relationships where they can build trust and have that in their life, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure Tim and Hugh have got questions for you as well. Yeah. If I might just ask one more very quickly, Hugh, and then I'll come straight to you. Just before we went into the 3 o'clock news, Hugh was talking about football being the only recreation available to people in the late, great Bill Shankly's hometown, for example. And then we expanded on that and talked about how important a or how simple and straightforward a recreational tool football can be. Dare I ask if, you know, for people who are homeless, for whatever reason, what role football plays and allows them to play?
I mean, I think, you know, football's a vehicle, you know, football's the thing in the middle of it, but it's what comes around football, whether you're watching football, playing football, or other sports and other kind of community activities. It's about kind of bringing people together, you know, and for 90 minutes, you can, if you've got stuff going on, you can leave it behind, you know, because you can focus on the football. But again, it's, you know, I think today in society, you know, we lack enough things that actually bring people together and people engage with one another. And, you know, we talk, you know, as a bit of a, you know, as a mental health crisis just now in the UK and across the world, particularly for young people, and that, you know, people and activity are, you know, that's part of the solution, physical activity and being around people. You know, young people are very isolated. They're more connected than they've ever been because of social media, but actually they're probably less connected from a human being perspective because their relationships are built through phones, and even here we're doing this on Zoom, you know. So I think, you know, football just is a level playing field. Anyone can play, you know, it's a flexible sport. You can play with four people, you can play with 10 people. Or back when I grew up in Govan in Glasgow, you used to play with 40 people of all ages. Your grandas, your uncles, the brothers, you know, everyone played. And it's probably the most accessible and inclusive sport there is. You know, there is a lot of sport out there which is a bit exclusive because, well, things like golf and stuff like that, you know, not everyone can play
polo.
That.
But actually, I was thinking polo. You have to be a king to play that. Yeah. So it's a bit exclusive.
Yeah, so I just think football, it's called a beautiful game for a reason. And I think it's not just the playing of it. It's, you know, we've seen the impact of COVID and stuff when people couldn't go to watch the football. And for a lot of, particularly kind of men in their kind of 40s and 50s, that was their only out. You know, that was their day off, you know, where they could go and socialise and speak to their mates.
Not being patronising, but from one's got to another, Hugh?
Yeah, well, we're in the presence of greatness here. We've got a Dotun, we've got a World Cup winner here, and David, he's been very humble. And what I'd rather than a question, because I know David's background in it, I would like to him to tell us just about his journey to make street soccer, because he's too humble to say it, but he's made this a huge thing all over the world, and it's come from, dare I say it, David, the most humble of backgrounds.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously we're here at the Homeless World Cup in Seoul, but, you know, my Homeless World Cup journey started 20 years ago, so I'd spent about 3 years as a young person homeless in Glasgow after my father's passing, and I just kind of lost my way a wee bit. You know, I was on the streets, I was, you know, in hostels and stuff like that, and football was the kind of rope that pulled me out of a dark hole. You know, it's I was lucky enough to meet a former Rangers captain, and sadly we lost a couple of years back, Ali Dawson, who was then the manager of the... So Ali was the kind of youngest ever Rangers captain to win, I think it was the Scottish Cup and stuff like that. Proper legend, a guy. But he was the manager of the Homeless World Cup team at the time, which was being run by The Big Issue. And I was staying in a hostel, and I went along to this kind of football tournament. There was kind of 16 teams from different hostels in Glasgow, and I managed to get picked for the team. And, you know, the tournament was in August in Sweden, but the trials kind of started in April. So for about 3 months, I had something positive in my life to look forward to, which was going down to see Ali, to train with my teammates, and actually felt worth something. You know, I actually felt a bit of self-worth. Played for Scotland, knocked out in the semis by Italy.
Typical.
And it happened the second year again after that. But I came back with a kind of newfound energy and newfound hope. And thankfully, I had a support worker, Alice, and the young person's supported accommodation I was staying in. And they encouraged me back into coaching. So I started coaching kids football. So that suddenly gave me, see that, you know, that structure, that wee bit of purpose in my life to kind of avoid. Sometimes when you don't have anything to do, it's quite high risk, you know, because you're left to your own devices. You don't have anything to, you're not planning for anything. You don't have anything to look forward to. So you're just trying to find ways of passing the day quickly. And when you're in an environment where there's quite a lot of danger and stuff like that, that could lead you into a dark place. But thankfully, football was, you know, I believe through every dark time there's always a wee crack which let some light in, and football was the light that kind of saved me. And then from there, went back to college because I'd dropped out of school at 13, no qualifications, kind of looking after my dad who was an alcoholic. And went back to college, trained as a community worker. So suddenly I got a full-time job working for the Big Issue Foundation. I was doing the football coaching with the kids, and then I became the manager, as she was mentioned, to the World Cup team who went and won the World Cup in 2007 in Copenhagen. And so everything just started to, you know, everything was going well. And I just thought that So the Homeless World Cup is this international tournament where players come from all over the world. But at the time, there was no regular stuff in Scotland. So there was no, you know, if someone needed access to the game or access, there was nothing there. So if we're going to scale change, it would have to happen at a kind of local level. So I quit my job in 2009 and started the charity Street Soccer with a bag of balls, you know, a second-hand laptop and a poster and a smile. And that's kind of grew now. So Street Soccer Scotland's 15 years old. We've supported 25,000 people. We've got 60 weekly projects running every week across 22 sites. And we're very lucky, you know, and we're lucky to have people like Andy Robertson involved and Martin Comston, and Sir Alex Ferguson was one of our founding ambassadors as well. So it's you know, it's just so important that people have something that they can be part of, they feel that they belong to, you know, because when you don't have anything to belong to or be part of, then it can create a lot of pain and suffering.
Tim?
That's fine. I'm seeing, certainly where I live in Brazil, but generally I'm seeing the problem of homelessness get worse and worse because later than perhaps happened in the UK, but it's the same cancer. It's the cancer of property prices rising by more than wages. So where a few years ago, the people who were rough were people who'd slipped through the net, and you'll always get that. Now you're seeing just families.
Yeah.
Just because they simply cannot afford to pay the rent. Now, I am the product of council housing. And I think that the biggest disaster that has happened in British society over the last 40, 45 years has been the destruction of council housing. I think there's almost any problem that you can talk about in UK life today could be bettered by a restitution of the tradition of council housing. So my question to you is, does this Homeless World Cup, does it come together as well as having the social function, but does it come together around a political program as well?
Well, it does. And actually, it's a great question. And part of the mission of the Homeless World Cup is to use the awareness that the World Cup creates and the stories and the stories of change it creates to influence policy and decision making. And actually here at the Hanyang University in Seoul, there's a all-day conference tomorrow. Everywhere the Homeless World Cup goes, they create these conferences to bring, you know, head of housing policy and all that together to talk about cities ending homelessness. So that's actually happening tomorrow. But I think there's a bigger movement happening, Tim, as well. So back in the UK, I'm involved in a thing called Homewards, which was launched by Prince William through his Royal Foundation to try and tackle and put an end to homelessness. So that's a 5-year project where Prince William's come in to kind of use his influence and voice to try and create change. But I think you're totally right. I think, you know, housing shouldn't be a commodity, it should be a human right. No. You know, and that's the starting point. You know, it's, you know, everyone deserves a place to call home and somewhere they can live, which is affordable, you know, and sadly with things like Airbnb and all these types of things are just pushing the market up because people are using housing as a commodity and it's a human right. You know, it's like, but the other important thing is as well, what that leads to is a health crisis. Because if you kind of think about the mother who's currently in a B&B with 3 young kids trying to kind of get through life, what's the impact on the kids' health and certainly the parents' health? You know, the stress and anxiety that brings. And actually, the system doesn't help either. You know, it's like sometimes you look at the way systems are designed, sometimes they're not there to help people, they're there to help the administration of that particular local authority or local government sometimes. So we need to fix all that stuff. There needs to be a bit of a rewire and a bit of commitment from leadership to say, no, this can't happen much longer. And the challenge is homelessness on the grand scale affects a smaller number. So sometimes politicians don't really look at it as much because it doesn't affect votes. But we need to put it top of the agenda because when COVID happened, We could do things very quickly, and we need to use that kind of ability to make decisions at the same pace as something like COVID, because homelessness is a crisis, but certainly for the people who are living it.
Look, I totally get why you have to necessarily bring forward a political as well as a social agenda on this platform. It's kind of what it says on the tin, isn't it? Homeless or World Cup of Homelessness, it kind of demands a kind of a political agenda as well. Do you not think, though, it distracts from the other aspects of this, which is the football? We haven't asked you yet if, you know, the football that you've seen so far in the World Cup is any good, and if the representatives from our side are going to get anywhere in this World Cup, for example. I think those two things go together, the football and the politics. But once you bring the politics in, it's such a big issue that do we not forget the football?
But I think that's the important thing about the Homeless World Cup, the fact that it's triggering these discussions. You know, there's people coming down with their kids and stuff like that, and kids are asking, Mummy, what's homelessness, or Daddy, what's home? And so, you know, it starts those conversations. That's why it's important. But going back to the football, it's weird now because I've now got two hats on, right, because street soccer, so I'm responsible for street soccer London and street soccer Scotland. So we've got two teams here.
Oh, my goodness. That's going to be some dilemma.
And an England team. And it's so funny because, like, you'll see that Irish people or people from abroad standing watching the game, and I'll be shouting, come on, England! And the big, staunch Glaswegian Southern accent. And they're looking, and I'm standing in a Scotland top at this point as well. Because obviously our organisation represents, but the football's been amazing. And it always is amazing because there's various standards, obviously, because, you know, every kind of team's different. And obviously the social, you know, cultural aspects of that. So in Mexico and Brazil, for example, the players tend to be a lot younger, you know, fitter, you know, because, you know, some of the players in Mexico come from really challenging backgrounds, but kind of their projects are run at scale, so they've got, you know, they can put together a strong squad. A lot of the Brazil players are coming from some of the favelas and stuff like that, and some of the, there's a great project, actually, Tim, you should check out, called Football Social. So they're the Brazilian Homeless World Cup partners, similar to street soccer, so they're based in Rio as well. So they should try and
just
get them
just
out.
A brief interruption. Brazil is a real power in the Paralympics. It's much more of a power in the Paralympics than it is in the Olympics. And part of that is good administration, but also part of that is the conditions of Brazilian society produce lots of people who qualify for the Paralympics. Like the number of road accidents, or even like snake bites and things that aren't cured quickly enough, and lead to conditions where. So it's a kind of paradox. Brazil being strong in these things, it's evidence of sometimes a good organisation, but also of underlying problems.
But there is a social and cultural aspect to football, Hugh, and just. Going on to what, you know, David's dilemma was between England and Scotland, I've got to ask you, consider me to be Dotton Tebbit for this. I think you know what's coming.
Yes.
When Scotland didn't they qualify in a World Cup, who do you support?
Never.
When Scotland didn't they
qualify?
Wait, hold on. You never know. If Scotland didn't they qualify in the World Cup, and England do, who do you support?
I support, I do the Andy Murray thing, which is anyone but England, you know. Yeah. I have a process, Norton. I tell you what, isn't it? I can tell you what the process is, because I can tell you about the Euros. I was over at the Euros watching Scotland. It was absolutely horrific watching Scotland. I'm still in some kind of trauma over watching the Scottish performances. But I went over fairly sort of neutral about England because obviously you've got English pals, you watch English football, you don't want to wish ill on anyone. But the process starts of being very, very neutral, and then it just clicks in. And there's like, it clicks into, you know, some, you start watching a television program where people we share broadcasters, of course, and you watch the television program for the Scotland games interrupted by going live to the England camp.
That's for horrible.
Some sort of maybe what lemonade that they might be bringing in to this. You're in the middle of this existential struggle against bloody Hungary here. Can we have a word about this? So that then it cramps up. I mean, there's always a tipping point where this antipathy becomes full-scale psychosis. And this year it was when I was watching. I was already very vulnerable, of course, because I'd just come back after watching this but absolute rubbish for three games. And I was watching an England game, and at half-time, in the England game, I can't remember which one it was, but it applied to them all, but England were obviously underperforming, and basically everyone was very, very mediocre. The halftime commentary, the commentators were talking about the brilliance of what I'd actually watched and described Phil Foden as the best number 10 in the world, as if this was just a statement of fact that nobody could, it was Gary Lineker's, so Phil Foden here, who's the best number 10 in the world, and I went, nah, that's enough, I'm now into full waving loony. Where is a red wig? Where's a kilt? Where did I put that rusty claymore?
That was an attack.
And this was all from 2 weeks before, saying, do you know what? I wouldn't mind if England won it.
Yeah, David?
I'm just saying, because sometimes people don't understand the whole Scotland-England thing. I was in a taxi in London, and the driver was saying, oh, why do you jocks hate us English so much? I says, well, we don't hate you as a human being. It's just a football thing. I says to him, what do you support? He's like, oh, I'm an Arsenal fan, mate. I say, were you cheering on Spurs a couple of seasons ago when they got to the Champions League final? Did you want them to win? It's like, no, I did the hell. It's the exact same. It's a football thing.
I totally get it. We've got to protect our grass if you happen to win. We've got to protect our grass, you know that. Mate, I've got to leave it here to go to the news, but tell me before we lose you, David, how we can find out more about Street Soccer Scotland and then maybe you can...
And how we can follow the World Cup.
Yeah.
Yeah, so exactly. So the Homeless World Cup, if you go to the website, homelessworldcup.org, all the matches are actually being streamed on FIFA Plus, which is FIFA have just agreed a new long-term partnership with the Homeless World Cup. So you can actually watch the matches live on FIFA Plus. But also, if you go into the YouTube channels as well, you'll be able to see the kind of highlights reel. In terms of Scotland, have started well, just for Hugh's information, we've played five so far. We've narrowly lost two games, one to Brazil. We lost 3-1. We hit the post three times. Believe it or not, we actually were the better team. Again, and
it's 1974 all over again.
Exactly. There you go. The post. And then England have actually are unbeaten, so they've won their five games so far, and they play Germany tomorrow. And both teams are still in with a chance of qualifying for the quarterfinals. So it's going well. And listen, thanks for getting us on, and I hope you can kind of check it out and share the love.
What about Street Soccer Scotland? Have you got a website?
Yeah, streetsoccerscotland.org.
Thank you. Anytime you like, keep us updated. Anytime you like, talk street soccer or talk World Cups or whatever you want to do. David.
We're 8 hours ahead, so it's perfect.
Well, you're not always going to be there, are you? I mean, the next time we speak, you might be home. You never know. Yeah. I mean, it's up to you.
Yeah.
It's entirely up to you. Oh, and also, mate, you've got so much history and knowledge of football and social conditions, not least in Scotland, that... Please contribute to the World Football Phoning. That's the kind of thing that makes this programme, jog along. And it's really informative. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. Good to
absolute
see you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Absolute pleasure. David Duke there from Street Soccer Scotland, who's in Seoul in South Korea for the Homeless World Cup. You can still join us. Oh, and by the way, in the next 20 minutes, we will anoint Zoe in Northampton with a Brazilian shirt name. If you haven't already texted on 85058 your suggestions for Zoe Northampton's Brazilian shirt name, make sure you do it. And if you prefer to email, then dotun, D-O-T-U-N, at bbc.co.uk. We'll go through a few others in a moment or two, but first, it's 3:34.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News on 5 Live. In his first speech to the Labour Party conference as Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer will warn of a shared struggle ahead to build a new Britain. But the party leader, who speaks later today, will also try to follow the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, in presenting a more positive vision for the future and light at the end of the tunnel. Health officials in Lebanon say nearly 500 people, including 35 children, have been killed by Israeli airstrikes. It's been the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border in nearly 20 years. And the former BBC radio and television presenter Chris Searle, best known for his role on the consumer affairs show That's Life, has died aged 81. Dame Esther Ranson described her Bristol-born former co-star as funny, clever and charming. Let's get the Five Live Sports now. Here's Shabnam Yunus-Jewell.
Everton could soon become the 10th club in the Premier League under majority American ownership. The Friedkin Group have reached an agreement to buy Farhad Moshiri's majority stake in the club, subject to approval from the Premier League, the Football Association and the Financial Conduct Authority. Manchester City fans are anxiously waiting on news of midfielder Rodri, who was substituted during the first half of Sunday's 2-2 draw against Arsenal. It's feared he could miss the rest of the season after initial tests showed damage to his ACL. City's 3 defeats last season came without the Spain international in the team. The League Cup tie between AFC Wimbledon and Newcastle has been moved to St James's Park next Tuesday after the London club's stadium was affected by flooding. The third round match was due to be played at the Cherry Red Records Stadium on Tuesday night. 4 games are still on. 5 Live will have commentary of Wycombe Wanderers against Aston Villa. Leeds United have announced plans to modernise and improve Elland Road. Part of the proposal is to increase capacity from just over 37,500 to around 53,000. The League Two Lancashire derby between Fleetwood and Morecambe ended in a 2-2 draw. And in cricket, Glamorgan won the One Day Cup for the second time in 4 years as they held on to beat Somerset by 15 runs. And on 5 Sports Extra on Tuesday from 12:15, you can hear England against Australia in the third One Day International. England are 2-0 down in the series heading into that match at Chesterley Street.
Matt Shawley,
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We are looking for a member of Matt's Parliament for New Forest East. Mick has got a claim. Hello, Mick.
In 1997, I proposed in a little hotel. I was actually in the bathroom.
What?
We were getting ready for dinner and I wanted it all to be sort of sorted before we went in and celebrated.
Lisa and Addy, it's such a safe culture media as well.
We're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are unfit owners can't become football club owners.
Matt Shawley,
Monday to Friday from 2
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
This is our wee part of the United Kingdom.
Live from here at Old Trafford.
I think it needs a massive overhaul.
Dotun Adebayo. Listen on BBC Science.
Yeah, great show tonight, says Mark, and thank you. Who also adds, so sad about the gent. Please give our sympathies to his family. Appreciate that. And here's one from our listener who says it was the 1933 FA Cup final. Do you remember that? No, I was only joking. I didn't mean that. Do you remember it as were you alive at the time? Because you told us, you know, you're only a couple of years older than me. But do you know anything about 1933 FA Cup final, Tim? Do you fancy having a go at that?
No.
Everton. War.
Dixie
war,
Dean?
Yeah, probably. Just about right for him. Everton wore 1-11. And Man City wore 12-22. I think that's what I saw. I think that's what I saw when I thought it was all the same numbers. That is what I saw. I think I've seen the clip of that. Yeah, 1-11 and we're 12-22. No relation to your 1-11. And we can add up and all. And family connections. My great-great-granddad, second from the left, here are Everton board sorting the 1933 Cup final applications. Ah, right. I can't see the picture, but I'm taking it your great-great-granddad, second from the left, was on the Everton board. Well done, you. Appreciate that. 08085 909693. You can join us for this morning's World Football Phoney. We've got the Scottish football writing legend, Hugh McDonald, with us. We've got the legendary Tim Vickery with us. And we've got Lisa with us in New York. And then we'll speak to Steve on South Tyneside. Bear with us, Steve. Lisa, hello. Welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks very much. Was it a Gooner? Is it a Gooner? What's your team again?
No, she's Nottingham Forest.
Oh, sorry, apologies, apologies.
There is
she's
a
that part of
though,
Brooklyn Heights,
you know?
Which is forever Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, yeah, Brooklyn Heights.
No, not quite, but, yeah. But we did, the reason they play in the colours they do is because we gave them their first kit.
Ah, that makes sense, that makes sense.
So there is a connection, although, unfortunately,
was it,
I guess.
Were you the first ones to rock up in, is it red?
I don't know if we were the first. I mean, we took the colours. I mean, it's the Garibaldi red from the Italian, from Garibaldi, from the shirts. That
let me make a note
wore,
of that.
But we definitely gave a kit.
Red.
We gave them, they didn't have the money for the kit, and we gave them their first kit, which was obviously red and white.
But it's Mansfield that you want to put on the map.
I did. Well, actually, the stadium, because as a Forest fan, it would be difficult for me to really talk about Mansfield. But
really?
Field Mill, which is, I think it's called One Call now, but I know it as Field Mill. It's the oldest professional football ground in the world. Mansfield didn't actually start playing there until something like 1919, but that has been in existence since about 1860.
Okay.
But the reason that I know a little bit about it is the first competitive floodlit match was played there. It wasn't the first ever floodlit match, but it was the first ever competitive match, and my grandfather was the referee for that game.
Wow. Oh my word.
Wow.
Oh my word.
Great stuff.
I'm so yeah. pleased we did this phone-in tonight.
It's first been of really all, interesting.
Do you mind telling us, I mean, I don't know how much you have heard about your grandfather, but I'd love to hear if he had thoughts on this floodlit experience as to
well I do before. It's funny because it's sort of a bit of a I knew this story about him having referee he I do remember my granddad he died in the 70s and I do remember him but we didn't talk unfortunately that much. He was also a scout for Notts County. In fact, the funny thing is the first time that my father ever saw my grandfather referee was a game where Forest were one of the teams. So my family up until then had all been Notts County fans, but my granddad sent a Forest player off and my dad Ooh. Didn't agree with it. And so the revenge was he became a Forest fan.
Yeah.
Oh, what a fabulous story.
Word. Yeah, that's a good story. That's a good story.
Great.
So yeah, but the it's funny because unfortunately, I mean, I remember seeing scrapbooks and things when I was a little girl of his time as a referee. In fact, I'd love to hear what he had to say about what's going on now with refereeing, but that's another matter. But quite recently, in the last couple of, occasionally, my auntie gave everything away, unfortunately, so I don't really have anything except for a few photographs. But more and more historical things are being put online. So once in a while, I'll look up, and a couple of years ago, I actually found a report of that match, the first floodlit game at Field Mill, and there's a photograph in the middle of the newspaper report, and my granddad is sitting in the middle, so I know for sure that it is true. And it said in the report that the referees were very complimentary about the amount of light that was illuminating the game. So Nottinghamshire Cup team game. For some reason, I have absolutely no idea why it would be that. But apparently, Field Mill wanted to be at the forefront for technology, and so they decided to host this with floodlights. And the representatives from Arsenal, Wembley came to watch the game. But yes. Unfortunately, a few months afterwards, the FA decided to ban floodlights. So that was in February 1930 that game took place. But in August that year, they banned them and there were no more floodlit games until the 50s, I think.
Later than that. I'm looking here and it says the next time that the floodlights are installed and officially switched on by Billy Wright, no less, was on the 5th of October 1961.
Wow.
It took 30 years for the FA to approve the floodlights after that.
I think the very first time they were used
was in the 1800s.
They'd be used in other countries as well, did you say?
Yeah.
Used in England at Bramhall Lane, but in 1878. But that wasn't considered a competitive match, so I'm not really sure on the history of that. But why, I don't know. I also don't know why. I've read many times that they banned them, but I don't really know why they banned them.
That's probably I've
no idea either, because it's being used with success in lots of other countries during this time. It's that mentality. I've never been able to understand this, because the process of the early years of football, it's just so revolutionary. Things happen so quickly. In my team, for example, Tottenham, it's a group of lads hanging around under a lamppost in what was rural Tottenham in 1882. Within 19 years, they've become a limited company. They have built their own stadium. When they win the FA Cup in 1901, the player from nearest to London is from Grantham, Lincolnshire. There's lots of Huey's boys come down from Scotland. So these years are just so revolutionary. And then suddenly, the people running the English game, suddenly they got so conservative. It's like, this is our world and we don't want it ever to change. So we're not going to bother playing in World Cups. We don't want floodlights. It's amazing to me how people who were so dynamic so quickly became so cautious and conservative.
So I'm reading the match report that I'm reading. It says the experiment was a unanimous success, with the referee and both captains going on record to discuss the quality of the lighting. And the game went so well that a representative of Wembley Stadium commented it would not be a surprise for Wembley to install similar lights.
Well, of course.
So it makes exactly what you're saying, Tim. It's really, really strange that despite all this support and the success of it all, the FA were like, no.
I think they missed a trick. Hugh, if I can turn to you, because today, or not even today, since I was a kid going to football matches, which is half a century. Exactly.
It's magic.
Exactly.
From,
don't you?
Rocking up to the stadium, you can see it from a few hundred yards away or something.
You can. And it's a sight and an experience, an aura that you never experience anywhere else. It's a football ground with four floodlights, one on each corner. It's amazing.
I rocked up the other day there with my son to watch Celtic v Slovan Bratislava in the Champions League. Interestingly, that Tim was talking about again with English and British, for that matter, authorities were very sniffy about the European Cup and didn't fully buy into it in the early days as well. And signs that you would be barred if you actually joined this awful competition that was obviously never going to be anything anyway. So, but the other day they turned up for the Champions League, and I still get that feeling of a match under the lights. It's just terrific. I mean, always there's a little ground in Somerset Park, which is in the air. It's got this actual leech stand. It's one of these beautiful old stand, and it has the old floodlights. And one of the great things down there is that here it always pours of rain. It's a holiday resort in Scotland, so obviously pours of rain. And one of the great things is sitting in the actual leech stand under the floodlights, watching the rain like tracer bullets coming across the pitch. It's just one of the great joys of watching football, I think, is watching that, And then Tim O'Brien says, one of the last big games that was under floodlights was a Copa Libertadores game. And it was just wonderful to go to Boca Juniors and watch Boca v Palmeiras under the lights, just to say to yourself, how did I get here?
Well, that's a good question. And Lisa, when you go to a football ground and you watch a game under the floodlights, I mean, maybe you go to American football or, baseball and they use floodlights.
No.
But, it's worth going to Yankee Stadium, I must admit. When I went there, I thought, okay, I'll let you off now, but I was up in the gods where I wouldn't eat the fast food if I were you. But anyway, do you not get a feeling, a tingle?
No, absolutely, yeah. And I know, any sort of special event, like if a new player arrives, it's always done under the lights. And people will comment, what's going on at the City Ground? The lights are on, something special's happening.
Yes, it's
a totally different atmosphere.
It was.
I think Bill Mills should be on the map for this.
I think it is. You know, it's not just should, it is. Why not? Field Mill, first competitive floodlit game was there. I think there's an aspect that Tim touched on and Hugh and you as well, Lisa, which is that I think today everything is like lights, camera, action. You know, everybody's got a mobile phone, the lights everywhere, blah, blah. The mobile phone is a torch if you want it to be a torch. There are lights everywhere to stop, you know, the miscreants, you know, creating havoc on our streets after nightfall. And you forget that it wasn't always like that. So when, just like you said a moment ago, Lisa, when the lights were on, you know, White Hart Lane was my local, as it were. Yeah, it could have been Highbury, but it was White Hart Lane. I wouldn't have seen the floodlights so clearly from Highbury because their walls were high. But at White Hart Lane, you could see the top of the floodlights and you could see that for miles around. So that question that you posed there, what's going on at you know, the City Ground because the lights are on, are exactly how I remember lights being on, particularly midweek, when they had, you know, sort of cup games or whatever, the lights being on in Tottenham, which was quite a sort of a dark and dingy and miserable area to grow up in. And I love the place, but, you know, it was economically challenged. So people were switching off their lights at home to save money, to not have to put another 5p in the electric meter. Whereas at Tottenham, there were like blazing it. It was like the place was on fire and it lit up the landscape. Mm. I remember there was this old, this is a true story. There was an old Caribbean woman. My friend, my good friend, went to buy her house, or he went to look at a house with the prospect of buying it. And she said, yeah, the good thing about this is, you know, in the front room, you don't have to have your lights on because, look, Tottenham, when they've got the floodlights. That's a true story. She said that. You know, it saved you money living in this house. Anyway, what a story. You took me back, Lisa. You took me back. And I'm sure
I tell you, there's a fantastic clip, BBC archive, if you ever look it up, of John Noakes at QPR going up on Blue Peter changing the light bulb on one of the towers.
John Noakes was the action man of Blue Peter. I'm not surprised in the least bit. I hope he didn't get electrocuted. Anyway, Lisa, thank you very much. Steve is in South Tyneside with us as well. Sabucho has been on the agenda this morning, Steve. Good morning.
Hi, Dot and Tim and all.
Hugh. Hugh McDonald. Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. I'm just sitting waiting to make a delivery. I thought I'd give you a ring. I've spoken to you before, but not on the football show. It's the first time I've run on the football show.
So you don't have to roll
out the barrel for me.
I don't have to, but I can't help it.
You can't resist it.
And we do love a lot of cream on our milk, don't we?
Fantastic.
If you like a lot of cream on your milk, then
join our club.
Yeah, indeed.
Hey, Dr. Studio.
Yeah.
Before it became a popular sport, it was a game called New Footy, which was developed around in Liverpool. Basically the same sort of players. They used to have cardboard in us rather than a three-dimensional figure. It was just like a piece of paper stuck in the top of the base.
Yes.
Yeah, but obviously the new footy version, on the base there was a lead washer. So obviously the nature of the game was to curl rather than slide.
Is this the one that he was talking about, Hugh, earlier on, the magnet one?
No,
is
it? No.
This is an original sort of development to Sabutio. During the war, there was a guy from Tunbridge Wells called Peter Adolf, who obviously decided to take a little bit further and developed it himself into a sliding bass rather than a curling bass, and managed to patent it and put an advert in the paper for some orders. He went away to America for about 4 months, I think it was, and he came back and he had about 150 orders. Hence, that's when it started. He wanted to patent the game. He's an ornithologist, and obviously he wanted to call it hobby football, but the patent office wouldn't allow him to do that, so he named it the Latin for hobby is subutio, subutio.
Fantastic.
I was genuinely going to ask you, do you know how the name came about? Oh my goodness.
Yep. Yeah, and also if you look at the subutio badge, it's a football with a falcon's head on the top.
I can't remember the badge at all.
Birdwatcher. Fantastic.
No, it was a gold badge with a football, like a circle, obviously with the hexagon sort of design on it. And sticking on the top was a falcon's head, like the neck and the top.
But subutio was Latin, though. Did you say it was Latin, subutio?
I think it was Latin or Greek, I think.
So if I might do the Shakespearean on this, e tu, Brute, then subutio.
obviously, since then, Waddington's bought it off him. Yeah. The Waddington's, the toy company, bought it off Peter Adolf on the tour of the year. And obviously, from then on, it just took off in the 70s. It was a very popular game, which I used to play on the carpet with my friend. Kneel on the players and everything. But in later years, I decided to, obviously, nostalgic-wise, looking back, I thought, I'm going to enter a tournament, and ended up going to Elland Road. There was a tournament in Leeds Football Ground, I think it was about 1992, where I met my best mate from the North East. He was actually there and playing, and we got together, and we started, after that, a friendship built up, and we started touring around England, going to all the clubs, playing in tournaments. We joined the Micclesfield Club in Yorkshire. Used to go down there every 2 weeks and compete with all the locals. And entered a national tournament called the Micclesfield Challenge Cup, where all the clubs used to play games, knock out, and the winners used to go forward and basically end up with two players. I was one of them. And I won the Micclesfield Challenge Cup in 1997.
Don't tell us anymore. Don't tell us anymore. Save that for the next time that I roll out the barrel for you, because mm-hmm. we've got to decide on what Brazilian shirt name we're going to anoint Zoe Northampton with. And I'd like you to join us for that, Steve. So if you would... it's a privilege, I'm sure, for us to have you join us to decide what Zoe's Brazilian shirt name should be. But Zoe herself is here as well. Hello, Zoe. Oh, Zoe's not with us. Oh, I thought Zoe would be here with us. Nevertheless, here are some suggestions for Zoe's Brazilian shirt name. Edward in Dallas says, since Zoe's from Northampton, I'm suggesting a Brazilian shirt name should be Zopatos. Tim, you're the only one who can translate that.
Shoes.
Yeah, shoes. Do you get it? Zapatos or Zapato?
No, Zapato. Yeah.
Zapato doesn't sound bad, does it? Yeah, you happy with that?
They're all done well.
You happy with that?
I'm happy with that, yeah.
No, I'm not asking you, I was asking Hugh. Hugh, you happy with that?
Yeah, all right. I'm happy with that, yep.
Yeah, okay, we've got some more. We've got to rattle through it, mate, because we've got only a couple of minutes to decide this. Derek in Aberdeen says Zoe's Brazilian shirt name should be Sandal Vesterveld. That's not a bad one. Sandal Vesterveld.
That's very good. Yeah? It's very good.
Who likes that, Steve? You happy with that?
I like it.
Yeah, that's good as well, yeah.
Yeah, and Hugh, you happy with that?
Yeah, I'm happy with that. It could be a Shui Gallica.
Shui Gallagher, oh, that's not bad. That is not bad. That is not bad. Oh, my word.
It's easier for him to
Gallagher.
Say as well.
Yeah, it's a lot easier for me to say and to remember. Shui Gallagher, let's go around the table. Shui Gallagher.
Yeah, it's in the lead.
Steve, Shui Gallagher.
Shui Gallagher sounds well to me, yeah.
Yeah, Shuey Gallagher. I think that's an elite. Well, let's decide now, and let's put Zoe out of her misery. Oh, Zoe is with us, is she? Let's find out whether Zoe likes Shuey Gallagher. I'm not sure if it's going to get any better than that tonight. Zoe, Shuey Gallagher? Shuey Gallagher? No, she's not. Zoe?
Hiya.
Shuey Gallagher, what do you think of that?
That's pretty good, yeah.
It's not bad. It's not bad. Otherwise, it's Cobblers. It's Cobblers. You know?
Cobbler-aldo.
Well, Cobbler-aldo, I know, but I wanted to, like, get her to think, you know, it's going to be abbreviated to Cobblers. Here's Cobblers in Northampton.
Yeah, I quite like the Schumacher one as well, but I think it's for you guys to...
Schumacher wasn't bad, actually.
Yeah, Schumacher was good.
Although, I would just say... Let's retire that one because, you know, Michael Schumacher, if he was here, I'm sure he would have a word or two.
It was Harald Schumacher, the German goalkeeper, who did a brutal foul in the semi-final against France. So Zoe's Schumacher. Better than that.
You've got to be. So, Shuey Gallagher or Schumacher, Steve, you decide.
Shuey Gallagher.
Shuey Gallagher it is. Zoe, from now on, you are Shuey Gallagher. Hey, thanks, Steve. Hugh, we can't thank you enough. Come back anytime soon.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 4 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. The Prime Minister will warn of a shared struggle ahead, but say there is light at the end of the tunnel in a key speech to Labour Party delegates today. In his first address at conference since taking office, Sir Keir Starmer will say tough decisions need to be taken to build a new Britain. Following weeks of criticism over cuts to winter fuel payments and donation transparency, activists in Liverpool told the BBC what they'd like to hear from the Prime Minister.
We've heard a lot about the deficit and the big black hole, but what we want to hear is, what are we going to do about it?
I'd like him to be much more optimistic. People have been in the realm of 14 years of complete devastation with no hope, not being able to put food on the table. So it's about giving people hope.
People in southern Lebanon have been fleeing their homes en masse after extensive Israeli airstrikes. The Lebanese Health Ministry said nearly 500 people had been killed in cross-border fire. The Israeli military said it hit around 1,300 Hezbollah targets. The White House has said that President Biden will present concrete plans for ending the crisis in Lebanon at the UN General Assembly this week. The EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, has been speaking at a news conference in New York.
The civilians are paying a high price in almost a full-blown war, which must be averted, including by renewing intense diplomatic mediation efforts. And here in New York is the moment to do that. Everybody has to put all their capacity to stop this path to war.
A ban on zombie-style knives and machetes has come into force in England and Wales. A four-week amnesty, which allowed people to hand in knives to the police without prosecution, has ended. It's now illegal to own, make, transport or sell a wide range of what are called statement knives, often used by criminal gangs. The number of illegally modified electric bikes confiscated by UK police forces rose significantly in the 12 months to August. 27 out of 46 forces responded to a Freedom of Information request by the Press Association. More than 900